Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, we love to get your requests for deep dives, and one we get all the time is, when was Deuteronomy written?
Yeah, it's a big question.
It is a big question. And thankfully, a listener sent in this great lecture transcript by Robert Van Noy.
Oh, Van Noy.
Yeah, it really lays out all these different scholarly perspectives on when Deuteronomy was written and... Well, it's fascinating. It really is. So today we're going to be doing a deep dive into the Deuteronomy dating debate. Get ready, folks, because we're about to do some serious time traveling.
Time traveling, yes.
Okay, so let's just lay it all out there. Was Deuteronomy written by Moses, as traditionally believed, or was it written, well, much, much later?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? And the answer has huge implications for how we understand not just Deuteronomy itself, but the entire Pentateuch.
The first five books of the Bible,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay, so the lecture starts out with, like, what are probably the most radical ideas? These are the so-called post-exilic theories.
Right. So these scholars, folks like Kennett, Holscher, and Barry, they place the writing of Deuteronomy after the Babylonian exile. So we're talking 6th century B.C. or even later.
Whoa, that's pretty late.
It is.
What evidence do they have to support such a late date?
Well, Kennett, for instance, argued that Deuteronomy's laws against idolatry.
Oh, right.
They're really strict.
Yeah.
He thought it'd be almost impossible to enforce those laws during a time when, frankly, idolatry was pretty common in Israel. So he figured, well, it must have been written after the exile.
When the community was a little more focused.
Exactly. Smaller, more focused on their religious identity, you know, trying to rebuild after this traumatic experience.
So it's like Deuteronomy becomes this blueprint for starting over.
Yeah. I like that, a blueprint. It's a way to kind of ensure the survival of their faith in this new context.
That new world.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got these post-exilic theories, but the lecture doesn't stop there, does it? It goes on to talk about what are called pre-621 BC monarchic theories. So now we're thinking, like, before the exile, but still during the time of the Israelite kings.
Yeah, we're moving back in time a little bit. Scholars like Ewald, Westphal, Ostriker, Welch, and Von Rad, they all fall into this camp.
Oh yeah, Von Rad, he's a big name.
Definitely. They see Deuteronomy as a product of the monarchy, but composed before those big reforms by King Josiah in 621 BC.
Right, right. Josiah's reforms, that's a key turning point, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. A huge religious and political upheaval. And many scholars think Deuteronomy actually played a pretty significant role in those reforms.
So what kind of role are we talking about here before Josiah?
Well, let's take Westphal, for example. He thought Deuteronomy may have actually been the inspiration for King Hezekiah's reforms. And those happened a whole century before Josiah.
Wow. So Deuteronomy's impact is like rippling through time. Okay, so we've got theories placing Deuteronomy after the exile, theories placing it during the monarchy. But hold on, there's more, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Buckle up. It gets even earlier.
So where are we going now?
We're going way back to before the monarchy even existed, the pre-monarchic theories.
Okay. Who are the folks championing these super early dates?
We've got scholars like Robertson and Brinker. They see Deuteronomy coming from a time when, well, the Israelites were transitioning from, you know, this more tribal society to a more centralized system, a monarchy.
So picture all these different Israelite communities, each with their own, like, customs, laws. Are they saying Deuteronomy was an attempt to, like, unify everyone?
That's the idea. Like, Robertson suggests maybe someone like Samuel, you know, he was a key figure in that transition to the monarchy. Maybe he was involved in compiling and shaping Deuteronomy to create this sense of national identity.
So it's like creating a national identity through shared religious laws and traditions.
Precise.
Okay. So even though we've got this huge range of dates, from super early to pretty late, it seems like all these scholars agree on one thing.
What's that?
That Deuteronomy was not written by Moses.
You got it. And that's one of the most striking things about this whole debate. Regardless of the specific date, these critical scholars, they're all united in challenging that traditional view.
Yeah, so that definitely throws a wrench into things.
It sure does.
Okay, so we've got these post-exilic theories, monarchic theories, even pre-monarchic theories. But the lecture isn't just about dates, right? It also digs into some really interesting debates about what Deuteronomy actually says and how people interpreted it throughout history.
Right, the content of the book itself.
Exactly. And one of the biggest debates revolves around this question of centralized worship.
Ah.
Does Deuteronomy require sacrifices to be offered only at one central sanctuary? Or does it allow for multiple places of worship?
That's a big one, yeah.
I mean, it has huge implications for how we understand the development of Israelite religion. Like, What was the role of the temple in Jerusalem?
Exactly. And as you can imagine, scholars have, well, they've come up with very different interpretations of the key passages that deal with this issue.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, and one scholar in particular, Ostraker, he really stands out in this debate.
Okay, so remind me, Ostraker puts Deuteronomy in the monarchic period, right? Before Josiah.
Yes, before Josiah's reforms. And get this, he argues that Deuteronomy actually doesn't require a single central sanctuary.
Really?
Yep. This challenges a core assumption of what's called the documentary hypothesis.
Wait, hold on. Documentary hypothesis? Refresh my memory.
Oh, right. So the documentary hypothesis, it's this theory about the authorship of the Pentateuch. Basically, it says that the first five books of the Bible were compiled from multiple sources, you know, earlier sources.
Got it. Okay, so how does Ostraker fit into all this?
Well, one of the key assumptions of the documentary hypothesis is that there was this big push for centralized worship in ancient Israel.
Okay, I'm following.
But Ostraker's saying, wait a minute, Deuteronomy doesn't actually require that.
So that kind of throws a wrench in the whole documentary hypothesis thing.
It definitely complicates things. It means maybe we need to rethink how the Pentateuch came together. But the question is, how does he back up this claim? Deuteronomy talks about, you know, the place the Lord your God will choose for worship. It seems pretty clear.
It does, yeah.
But Ostraker says, well, the original Hebrew, it can be translated differently. Instead of the place, it could be any place which the Lord your God shall choose.
Oh, so it's all in the wording.
Right. It's a subtle shift, but a huge difference in meaning. Ostraker argues that this reading allows for multiple sanctuaries, which is more in line with what we know about Israelite religious practices, at least before the exile.
They were worshiping at all sorts of local shrines, right?
Exactly. So it's like this tiny change in translation could rewrite our understanding of ancient Israelite religion.
Mind-blowing.
Isn't it?
It's like we're doing detective work, sifting through these ancient clues.
That's a great way to put it.
We're looking at language, history, archaeology, trying to piece together the puzzle of Deuteronomy.
Exactly.
But we've only just scratched the surface, haven't we?
You're telling me. There's so much more to this lecture. Like, Von Rad's approach, he's got this whole fascinating thing with what's called form criticism.
Form criticism. Okay, I'm intrigued. What is that, and what does Von Rad do with it?
So form criticism is a way of analyzing texts by looking at their, you know, structure, their genre. And Von Rad, he also dates Deuteronomy before Josiah, but he notices that it shares some interesting similarities with ancient covenant renewal ceremonies.
So he's not just reading it as a law code. He's seeing it as like a script for a ritual.
You got it. He thinks Deuteronomy was meant to be performed and acted, you know, not just read in private. And this actually helps explain some of its unique features, like that kind of sermonic style, the emphasis on covenant and obedience.
Wow. So it's not just what it says, it's how it was used. Okay, so we've gone from Moses on a mountain to post-exilic scribes, kings and reforms, ancient rituals, form criticism. I'm exhausted.
I know, right? It's a lot to take in.
But clearly this question of when Deuteronomy was written, it's, well, it's far from settled.
Definitely not settled, but that's what makes it so exciting. This deep dive is showing us that the Bible is not just, you know, a static collection of rules. It's a living document with a rich and complex history of interpretation.
And that history is still being written today.
Absolutely. Welcome back to our Deuteronomy deep dive. Before the break, we were talking about how even scholars who put Deuteronomy in that pre-monarchic period, they still reject the idea that Moses actually wrote it.
It's really interesting how each scholar kind of brings their own perspective, their own lens to Deuteronomy, you know, like it shows how much our understanding of the Bible depends on interpretation. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just about the words on the page. It's about how we read them, the context we bring to them.
Right. And speaking of different interpretations, we were starting to get into one of the biggest debates around Deuteronomy.
Oh, you mean like what it actually says?
Exactly. Specifically, whether it mandates worship at only one central sanctuary.
Ah, yeah. That's a big one.
You were explaining how scholar Moshe Ostraker, he really challenges the traditional view on that, right?
Right. He does.
Can you remind us, what's his argument again?
Sure. Ostraker argues that Deuteronomy 12.14, you know, the verse that everyone points to about the place which the Lord your God shall choose. Well, he says it can actually be read as any place which the Lord your God shall choose.
Oh, I see. So instead of saying there's just one special sanctuary, like the temple in Jerusalem.
Exactly. Yeah. It could be saying that God can authorize worship in multiple locations.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And you said that aligns better with what we know about how the Israelites actually practiced their religion, right? Like before the exile, they were worshiping all over the place.
You got it. At various local shrines, not just at the temple. So it's like we're piecing together these clues from the Bible, from history, from archaeology, to get a fuller picture of ancient Israelite religion.
Like a historical whodunit. We're the detectives.
Huh. I like that. We are.
But, you know, it also makes me realize why this question of when Deuteronomy was written is so important. It's not just about Deuteronomy. It's about how we see the whole context of Israelite history and religion, right?
Absolutely. Change the date. You change everything around it. It's like a ripple effect.
Speaking of ripples, remember the Amphictyony theory we touched on earlier?
Oh, yeah. That one's a bit of a doozy.
It is. It still kind of confuses me. How does that whole thing connect to Deuteronomy?
Okay, so just to recap, the Amphictyony theory. It proposes that the early Israelites, they were organized into this kind of, well, tribal confederation, and they were united by their shared worship at one central sanctuary.
Right, right. So some scholars think Deuteronomy reflects that early structure. Maybe it even functioned as a kind of constitution for this tribal league.
Exactly. Imagine it. All these different tribes with their own customs, their own territories, but they come together at this central place. And it's a way to reaffirm their covenant with God and with each other.
So it's not just about sacrificing animals. It's about reinforcing their identity, their unity as a people.
Right. It's about belonging, about shared beliefs and practices. And that helps us understand why Deuteronomy puts so much emphasis on those covenant renewal ceremonies, you know?
Okay, yeah, I see that connection. But I gotta be honest, it still feels a bit speculative. Like, do we have any solid evidence for this Amphictyony thing?
Well, hard evidence is tough to come by, especially when we're talking about ancient history.
That's true.
But the folks who support this theory, they point to certain things in Deuteronomy that seem to reflect this tribal structure. Like, it really emphasizes those tribal boundaries and how the land is divided between the different tribes.
So even if we don't have, like, an inscription that says, "Welcome to the Israelite Amphictyony," the text itself might be giving us hints.
Exactly. But remember, it's just one possible interpretation. As we've seen, there are other scholars with different ideas about Deuteronomy's origins, like Robertson and Brinker. They also put Deuteronomy in the pre-monarchic period, but they see it more as a unifying force that helped to bring those different tribes together.
Right, right. So they're not saying it reflects this already existing confederation. They're saying Deuteronomy helped create that unity.
That's it. They argue that the book's focus on covenant, on law, it helped create a sense of shared identity even before there was a monarchy.
Okay, so even within that pre-monarchic camp, there's disagreement. It's like every time we peel back a layer, there's another layer underneath.
It's like an onion. And, you know, we also have to remember the traditional view, right? There are still many people of faith who believe Deuteronomy was written by Moses.
Oh, absolutely. And while we're focusing on critical scholarship in this deep dive, it's important to respect all those different perspectives, you know?
Totally. Different people approach these questions from different places.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that the dating of Deuteronomy has this ripple effect on how we understand the Bible. Can you give an example of what you mean?
Sure. Think back to Ostriker's argument about centralized worship.
Oh, right. He says Deuteronomy might not actually require a single sanctuary, even though that's what most people have thought.
Exactly. And remember how we discussed the documentary hypothesis?
Yeah, that's the theory that the Pentateuch was compiled from multiple sources.
Right. And one of the big pieces of evidence for that theory is that there seems to be this tension, you know, between some passages that seem to advocate for centralized worship and others that seem to allow for multiple sanctuaries.
So some scholars have said, well, those different viewpoints must reflect different sources that were woven together.
Precisely. But if Ostriker is right, if Deuteronomy itself doesn't require just one sanctuary, then that whole argument kind of weakens, doesn't it?
It does. It's like pulling a thread and the whole tapestry starts to unravel.
Ah. Great analogy. So yeah, Ostriker's interpretation of Deuteronomy, it could make us rethink the documentary hypothesis and how we understand the composition of the whole Pentateuch. It's a big deal.
Wow, I hadn't thought of it that way. That's pretty mind-blowing. But, you know, all this talk about sources and hypotheses, it can get a bit abstract. Maybe we can get a little more concrete.
Sure. What did you have in mind?
Well, we've talked about how scholars use textual analysis. They look at the historical context, but they also use archaeology, right, to help date Deuteronomy. Can you give us an example of how that works?
Absolutely. Let's say archaeologists are excavating an ancient Israelite settlement. Okay. And this site dates back to, let's say, the 8th century BC, the time of the monarchy. And during the dig, they find evidence of a local shrine, a place where people were clearly offering sacrifices.
Okay, I'm picturing it. So if scholars thought Deuteronomy said you could only worship at a central sanctuary, this finding would kind of contradict that, right?
Exactly. It would suggest maybe the book was written later, after this practice of having local shrines was already established.
Or it would support Ostricker's view, right? That Deuteronomy allows for multiple sanctuaries.
Right. So archaeology can provide this tangible evidence that either supports or challenges our interpretation of the text.
It's like a window into how people were actually living their religion, not just what the texts say.
I love that. You're right. It's about connecting the text to the real world of ancient Israel.
Exactly. But then again, I guess archaeology can be just as open to interpretation as the Bible itself.
Oh, for sure. What one archaeologist sees as evidence of a particular practice, another archaeologist might interpret it totally differently.
Right, right. It's all about perspective, isn't it?
It is. That's why it's so important to consider all the evidence and be aware of any potential biases that might be influencing how we interpret things.
So once again, we're back to the idea that there's no easy answer when it comes to dating Deuteronomy.
Nope. No easy answers. But that's okay. I think this deep dive is really highlighting the complexity of the Bible and the challenges of interpreting these ancient texts.
It's definitely making me appreciate how much work goes into it.
It's a journey. It takes patience, curiosity, and a willingness to sit with uncertainty.
Well said. And speaking of journeys, we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, but there's still more to explore.
Yes, we still need to unpack von Rad and his form criticism approach and delve into some of the broader implications of this whole debate.
It seems like every answer just leads to more questions.
That's the beauty of it.
It is pretty amazing. Well, we'll be back soon to continue unraveling the mysteries of Deuteronomy. Welcome back. It feels like we've really traveled through like centuries of biblical scholarship, you know, trying to figure out this whole, when was Deuteronomy written?
We really have. We've looked at theories that put it super late after the exile, all the way back to, you know, before there even was an Israelite monarchy.
I know. And it's crazy how each theory has these totally different implications for how we understand not just Deuteronomy itself, but like the whole Pentateuch. Even how Israelite religion developed.
It's been quite a journey. A lot of twists and turns, a few dead ends even.
Speaking of dead ends, I gotta be honest, my head is still spinning a little bit.
Yeah.
Like from all these different theories, is there like one that you find most convincing or like what do you think?
That's a great question, but it's also kind of a tricky one. You know, we've talked about how there isn't one right answer when it comes to dating Deuteronomy. Every theory has its own strengths, its own weaknesses, and at the end of the day, it really comes down to each individual, like how they weigh the evidence, which interpretation makes the most sense to them.
So you're saying there's no like smoking gun, no one piece of evidence that just settles it all.
Exactly. It's more like a puzzle, but like a puzzle where the pieces come from different boxes. We're trying to make them fit, but there are always going to be some gaps, some pieces that, you know, just don't seem to belong.
Okay. Yeah, I get that. But it's also like kind of frustrating. You know, I like when things are neat and tidy, black and white.
Oh, I hear you. It'd be nice if it was all straightforward, right?
Hmm.
But in the world of biblical scholarship, ambiguity, well, that's kind of the name of the game.
All right, all right. Embracing the ambiguity, even if it makes my brain hurt a little bit. But maybe we can, like, zoom in on one specific place where this whole ambiguity thing really stands out, okay?
Sure. Which area were you thinking of?
What about the whole centralized worship debate? Mm-hmm. We talked about how some scholars, like Ostricker, they argue that Deuteronomy doesn't actually mandate just one place of worship, even though traditionally that's been the view.
Yeah, right. That's Ostricker's big thing.
Right. And you explained how, you know, his interpretation of that key verse in Deuteronomy 12.1, it opens up the possibility for multiple sanctuaries.
Exactly. And this isn't just like an abstract debate about what one verse means. It has big implications for how we understand how Israelites actually lived out their religion, like in different historical periods.
So if Ostricker is right, it means maybe the idea of a single central sanctuary, like the temple in Jerusalem,
yeah,
it maybe developed later than we thought. Maybe even after the exile.
That's one possibility. It challenges this assumption that, you know, centralized worship, that it was like the defining feature of Israelite religion from the very beginning.
I think we're rewriting the history of like how ancient Israelite religion actually evolved, you know.
Right. We're piecing together a new story.
But I'm also thinking about the implications for how we understand the whole Pentateuch, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Remember we talked about the documentary hypothesis, that theory about how the Pentateuch was compiled from all these different sources?
Right.
And one of the big arguments for that theory is that there seems to be this tension between, like, passages that advocate for centralized worship
Yep.
and others that, like, seem to allow for multiple sanctuaries.
Exactly. So some scholars said, aha, see, different sources, different viewpoints woven together.
Right. But if Ostriker is right, and Deuteronomy doesn't actually require a single sanctuary, then that tension, well, maybe it's not as big a deal as we thought.
Right. It could be that the whole argument was based on, well, a misunderstanding of what Deuteronomy was really saying.
It's like that whole tapestry thing again.
You know, yeah.
You pull on one thread.
And who knows what unravels.
Exactly. So, yeah, Ostriker's interpretation of Deuteronomy, it could lead us to completely re-examine the documentary hypothesis and how the whole Pentateuch was put together.
It's a big deal for sure.
It's a huge deal. Wow. This is really making me think. It's amazing how one book can spark so much debate, so many different interpretations.
It really shows the power of these texts, doesn't it? How they continue to challenge us, to make us ask new questions, even after all these centuries.
Yeah, I think our listeners' brains are probably full after all this. We've covered so much, you know, the different theories, the evidence, the challenges of interpreting these ancient texts.
It's been a whirlwind.
It has. But I think the most important thing isn't about finding, you know, the answer. It's about engaging in the process of asking the questions, thinking critically, and wrestling with the ambiguity.
Couldn't agree more. It's the journey, not just the destination.
Well said. And on that note, it's time to wrap up our deep dive into the fascinating world of Deuteronomy. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep those minds curious.